You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 18th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
It's Jay's turn to be away this week, although he may join us later. Those maybes are always dodgy. But Jay's out of town, but is going to try to join us from his hotel when he's available.
Right.
But Kara, you're back from your trip. How was it? Tell us
Yay.
What happened.
It was awesome, you guys. I don't know if I'm allowed to say what the story was, but I think I'm finally allowed to say, or maybe I'm breaking the rules, but I don't really care, that I have joined the cast of Explorer on National Geographic, which is very exciting.
Cool.
Whoa, awesome. Congratulations.
One of their longest running shows. Yeah. And I got to travel for two different stories around the U.S. I went to San Francisco, and then I went to Connecticut, actually, and stopped off at Yale.
Hey.
I texted Steve from across campus and said I was waving to him. And then went on to Paris, and then I filmed in Morocco for about a week. And we got to go into the Sahara Desert, which was incredible, and hang out with some Sahrawi and ride around on camels and do a lot of very fun things. And I ate so much tagine, and now I miss it. Coming home was a huge bummer because I've got to
find... What the hell's that?
Tagine is like a really traditional...
Is that like a McDonald's hamburger over there or
something? No. there was a McDonald's
Lambert.
In Paris, and we were like, what the hell? And I think we might have seen a McDonald's in Casablanca, but where we were hanging out, we entered into Casablanca, and then we traveled kind of across to Rabat, and then to Erfoud, and then to Rissani. And then we went to a very small town called Mhamid, where we were able to go out to Erg Shigaga, which was out in the sand dunes in the Sahara, and then came back through Marrakesh. So I really saw most of the country because we drove in between all of these different locations for filming. And there was a McDonald's in a big city. But for the most part, you know, you eat what the locals eat, and there's a lot of tagine. Remember, you've probably seen them before, these pottery pieces that are almost like a deep dish, kind of like a plate that's quite deep, like a bowl. And then it has a top over top that looks almost like a chimney. It's like a conical shaped with a hole in the top. And that's how they make tagine. So oftentimes it'll be lamb or chicken, and it'll have a lot of really yummy like peppers and onions and local vegetables and some
sauce. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and then it'll cook over the course of hours in an oven or on charcoal. And it'll kind of like – it has that little steam hole at the top to slow cook. And it's amazing.
Mm.
And, you know, it's North Africa. They use a lot of spices like I think there's cumin in a lot of things. There was what's the yellow spice that's not saffron?
Oh, okay. I was going to say.
Yeah.
Oh,
gosh.
Yeah.
It's not coriander. It's – well, anyway, coriander is a big spice there too. So super, super delicious. Also, apparently in Morocco – Fridays are couscous days, apparently, and it's like a kind of a nationwide thing where people work really hard on a really delicious couscous. So the day that we came in, we were treated to some really wonderful couscous, and it was great.
Nice.
I have almost never eaten as well as I did when I was in Morocco. There was one night when we were interviewing this wonderful nomad gentleman who brought us into his home, and he served dinner for the entire crew. And it
turmeric.
Was like,
wow.
Turmeric, thank you. Yes, we've talked about turmeric on the show too. How could I be blanking on that? So much turmeric.
Not a turmeric.
It's so good. But there was this really wonderful guy, and we all sat down at these low tables. They also serve Moroccan tea with like almost every meal. And Moroccan tea is this very special kind of green tea with mint, and it's sweetened. It's very, very sweet, and it's delicious. And they have this special way that they pour it, where they pour it once and they put it back in the teapot and they re-pour it and they aerate it. And it's so freaking good. And so he served us all tea and then the freshest, most delicious medjool dates. They're all like in season right now. And all the trees were just busting with these delicious, gooey dates. Lots of almonds there in Morocco. And then they served like what they call salad, which is just a plate of different kind of in-season vegetables. And for some reason, there's almost always tuna on the plate, which is a little weird, and cold rice. And then a chicken tagine, and then a freaking half a lamb, just like blunk on the table. And it was delicious. And this really good bread that they make fresh. and for some reason also French fries with every meal. But I don't know if that's the French influence because, of course, Morocco is a French colony. So they speak Moroccan Arabic and French in Morocco. It's an Arabic country, of course, like heavily Arabic, but they've kind of got their own language. And also there are still people there that were Berber people, and their written language looks like alien, and it's amazing. If you've never looked at written Berber is called, I don't know if I can pronounce that, Tifinagh? Tifinagh. And it is amazing looking. Like, everybody should Google it right now. It looks like an alien language. And I was even saying that to some of the Berber people I was hanging out with, and they were laughing about it. They're like, yeah, it totally does. So yeah, it's a really cool culture. A lot of mixed individuals from varied backgrounds. Beautiful country and very welcoming. And goodness, do I miss the food.
Tagine refers to the cookware. So it's like...
There you go.
Yeah.
But they always call the food tagine too.
Yeah, right. But,
it's cooked in the tagine.
Right? Exactly. Hmm. Did you see any really interesting wildlife?
I did. I did not see a fennec fox. I was so hopeful to see a fennec fox, but apparently they're really, really hard to see. I think they're crepuscular and they are –
good word.
I don't know. One of the guys that I had spoken to, actually our fixer, had helped out on a BBC production there. Where they were just filming fennec foxes. It was like a feature on fennec foxes, and it was days and days and days in the desert waiting to find them. So I wasn't too surprised that we didn't see them. But we did see Barbary macaques, which is apparently the only native primate to Morocco. And I had never seen a monkey in the wild before. And so that was incredible.
Did they call them the Barbary primates?
The Barbary primates?
Sounds like Barbary Pirates.
Oh, I was like, well, I don't get it. Sorry. But yeah, it was really cool to see them in the wild. Unfortunately, they hang out in these forests, sort of in these oases in the desert, and they're so used to people stopping and feeding them that they're incredibly comfortable around people. And people were all stopping and taking selfies with them, which made me quite sad. Yeah. I took some pictures from afar, but I didn't want to get too close. And then also... This is one thing that bums me out about Morocco. There are tons and tons of feral dogs and cats. They're everywhere.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And one of the people that we were hanging out with that lived in Morocco was like, no, they're wild. They're wild. And I was trying to say, like, there's no such thing as a wild Canis domesticus or wild, you know, basically house cat. But in their view, they're wild animals. And so they're treated as such. Sometimes they'll throw them food, but they're definitely feral. There's a good chance they carry disease, and they're
everywhere
on the sides of the roads, on the highway. You'll just see these. I mean, it's quite jarring. These adorable puppies and dogs that are probably quite vicious and not used to interacting with people, and they're just sleeping on the sides of the roads and in the marketplaces. The cats are all crawling around your feet.
It's interesting.
Yeah,
we domesticate these animals and then release them back into the wild to get back to their roots in a sense it's peculiar.
It's peculiar, and it obviously is not very good for the kind of biome, the, you know, ecological niche there, because dogs and cats are, you know, they're cats are carnivorous, dogs are omnivorous, but they are predators. They will, you know, hunt rodents and things like that, and perhaps take food out of the mouths of some of the natural predators that are there. So interesting, like there could be a whole other story about that, and I'm wondering how many other places in the world that's really a problem.
Yeah, but we had a big feral cat population in Cheshire, which is one town north of where I'm living now. But they really got it under control. You know,
it's like I feel like with a concerted effort of a spay and neuter thing, you can really take care of it. But it was so cool. You know, we were right there at the end of the road. One of the nomads that I was hanging out with was telling me that his father used to ride from where we were in M. Hamid all the way to Timbuktu. And we're quite close to the Algerian border. And of course, Algeria is not the safest place to travel right now. So it was sort of a militarized zone, but I felt very safe. And it was just really incredible to spend time. Also, Morocco is a place where so many fossils come from. So I came home with a massive, beautiful fossil. And I got to hang out in a museum where a guy specializes in trilobites and in taking care of the trilobites that have like the really long kind of tentacles you know, the super fragile, beautiful mm-hmm. trilobites. He had some incredible specimens he was working on. So that was a lot of fun, too.
So did you purchase it or find it?
No. I mean, I found some on the side of the road, but they're not nice. You know, they're kind of junky. But I purchased. They're beautiful. They're like usually black and white. They kind of look like marble. Orthoceras. So if you Google Orthoceras, you'll see what I got.
Cool. All right. Well, welcome back, Kara. And you can get
Thank
us started with what's the word?
Absolutely. All right. So the word today was recommended by Dick Holcomb from Seattle, Washington. And he recommended that we talk about the word epicenter. And he said that technically the epicenter is the point on the Earth's surface directly above the focus of an earthquake. However, in more recent and more common usage, the meaning has evolved and diluted to mean the center of something. Somehow people in the press these days think that being at the epicenter of something sounds cooler than being at the center of something, even though they mean the same thing. That's too bad. I think it's a case of losing scientific accuracy for no good reason. And then he talks about how he worries that the same thing happened with penultimate. People misuse it as ultimate. So I thought we would unpack this a little bit. And Dick, of course, you're right. According to almost every dictionary I consulted, according to every dictionary I consulted, epicenter as a first definition, meaning that it happened the first, it was first recorded in time, is the point on the Earth's surface that's directly or vertically above the focus of an earthquake. Of course, the focus of an earthquake happens deep within the Earth. The epicenter is actually the place on ground where you would be standing and could mark that, you know, the place where the seismograph is picking that up. But that is just definition number one. Definition number two is in almost every single dictionary I consulted, and it's exactly as Dick described. It just says simply the epicenter is the center or the central point or the focal point or the point of the highest activity. You'll often hear it referred to like the epicenter of global finance or the epicenter of scientific innovation. And it's been there for some time. So I guess what I would say is that like it or not, language does evolve and sometimes a technical term does make its way into the lexicon. I personally don't think that this is a bad thing. I actually kind of appreciate it, especially in this situation. I think it helps scientific language become more accessible to the world, and it also offers a new way to speak and think about something that may have not had a good label in the past. But at the same time, to your point, Dick, I think that we should be careful when we do use the word epicenter to not use it when we simply mean center. If something is the center of something, it is just the center of something. But in a more kind of poetic, I guess you could say, or metaphorical sense, when we talk about the epicenter of something, what we could really be referring to is a place or an event or a point in time where great changes radiated. Like we could be talking about something being the epicenter of something. It's not just the center of something, but it's the center of change that radiated out from there. Because in a way, that is, I think, a more appropriate use. And I've come across a couple different bloggers, like literary bloggers and editors, who recommend the same usage. As far as etymology is concerned, epicenter was first used in a geological sense in the late 1800s. It's taken from the modern Latin epicentrum. And if we break it down into its component parts, epi, the prefix actually means on or above. So right there, that makes sense. And center, this part surprised me. Center literally translates to the middle point of a circle. The first time center was used, its component parts translated to sharp point, prick, or nail. And it referred to the center of a compass around which the string or the pencil or the rock or whatever would revolve. So center in that sense really came from an early usage talking about the center of a circle using a compass as a tool. Who would have thunk?
How about centroid?
Yeah, probably the same root usage. And then oid usually refers to something being like something else.
Yeah, I looked it up. It's basically the center of a triangle.
Oh, centroid. Neat. Okay, yeah. But it probably came back to that same center etymology. And it's super weird when you break apart center and look at where that word first came into being. It was specifically the center of a circle.
All right, well, let's move on to our news items. We're going to start with a discussion of climate sensitivity. Do you guys know what that is?
I know what it sounds like.
Yeah, I do.
It has a very specific operational definition.
Context clues. What is it?
Climate sensitivity is the amount of warming of the average temperature on Earth that will result from a doubling of pre-industrial carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere.
That is not what I thought it was.
Yeah. So it's basically how sensitive is the climate to the increases in CO2. Yeah, this is sort of the question at the very core of global warming, the scientific question. And this is also, and I'm bringing this up now because this is increasingly becoming a target for the global warming deniers, because all they have to do is say that climate sensitivity is really low. You know, we could dump a ton of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We could double or more, and it will have a very small effect on global temperatures. So, but here's the scientific answer.
All right. It's the real
answer. Yeah. So I'll circle back to the global warming denial stuff too, because again, what's triggering this is a recent paper, which is again arguing that climate sensitivity is essentially, if you look at the literature, it's been decreasing and it's heading towards zero. I mean, they want to basically say it's zero. But it's total pseudoscience, that article. We'll get to that in a moment. But sorry. So here's for some background. The International Panel on Climate Change says that, you know, the consensus of scientific evidence is that there is a range of climate sensitivity from 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius. Some references give it as 1.5 to 4.5. It's essentially 3 plus or minus 1.5 degrees. So 3 is essentially the average figure. If you average all of the estimates of climate sensitivity of all the papers, all the various models, 3 is the average. And the 1.5 or 2 to 4.5 is the two standard deviations, is the 95% confidence interval. So the chances are overwhelming that it's going to be somewhere in there. Obviously, we'd like to hope that it's going to be towards the lower end, but it's just as likely as it's going to be towards the higher end, and it's probably going to be close to three degrees. And again, this is for, you know, arbitrarily for a doubling of the CO2. It doesn't mean that releasing CO2 into the atmosphere magically stops at that point. It will keep going. So there are a few different ways that we estimate climate sensitivity. One is by looking at detailed climate models, right? And these are, of course, the most controversial because, you know, they're only as good as the input that we put into them. But the climate models have been refined and refined and refined, and they're getting pretty good. I mean, the climate models are actually pretty good at this point. Then the second line of evidence is combining recent climate measurements with climate models. And sometimes they'll use like a simplified climate model, and then they'll plug in some actual measurements of what's happening recently in order to calculate climate sensitivity from that. And then the third method is past climate changes, like historical, thousands of years ago, millions of years ago, looking at what was the CO2 at that time and what was the average temperature at that time, and then extrapolating from that to essentially the relationship between atmospheric CO2 and global temperatures. Every method has its strengths and weaknesses. No one method is perfect. Each of these methods is requires a complicated, you know, modeling and calculations, and there's always room for differences of opinion, which is why there's a range, you know, of answers, not just a one answer. The easier question to answer is, if there were no feedback mechanisms, what would be climate sensitivity just from the effects of CO2 itself? And there, the answer is about 1 degree Celsius. So if we double CO2 and there were no feedback mechanisms in the Earth or in the climate, that would result in about a 1 degree warming. But there are feedback mechanisms. And calculating the effect of those feedback mechanisms is where a lot of the complexity comes in for the model approach, right? Using climate models to figure it out. So like the biggest ones are water vapor in the atmosphere, because increased CO2 increases water vapor, you know, increases temperature, which increases water vapor. And water vapor is actually a much more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2 is. So it's a tremendous magnifier of the effect. You know, even a little bit of increase in water vapor will have a dramatic increase in the overall warming. Another one is the decreasing poles, ice at the poles, right? So the less ice reflects, you know, sun and therefore heat back away from the Earth. And as ice melts, we're reflecting less, absorbing more, and that reinforces the warming. And then clouds are the third one, and clouds are a mixed bag. Clouds can either increase or decrease warming depending on the kind of clouds and their altitude. Some clouds, you know, reflect sunlight away, and that actually reduces warming, and others... but clouds also themselves trap heat, and that increases warming, and so it depends on the altitude of the cloud and other variables. And that's probably the most complicated one to model. As cloud coverage increases, what's the net feedback effect that that has on climate sensitivity? But taking all those things and looking at historical evidence and current changes, the answer seems to be 3, with a 95% confidence interval, plus or minus 1.5 degrees. If you recall, and this came up in the context of the Paris Agreement, the point at which scientists think that bad stuff is going to happen is 2 degrees, right? So 3 is more than that. And even at the low end, even if we're at the low end, we're at 2 or close to 2 for once we get to a doubling of CO2 pre-industrial levels. We're about 40% of the way there now. And unless we make a major change, we're going to get to a doubling by mid-century. If we continue at our current rate, which we just, we can't do. So obviously we have to put the brakes on to CO2 release in order to not get to that point, not cross over that 2 degree threshold where the world becomes much, significantly less hospitable to humans. So now the recent thing is a paper that was put out, again, looking at published studies of climate sensitivity and then plotting them, showing that it's been decreasing over time, and then extrapolating that trend down to zero. Like, as we do more research, the climate sensitivity has been diminishing over time. The problem with this paper is that it's utter crap.
that tends to be a problem.
They're cherry picking. They're cherry picking horrible papers published in throwaway or obscure journals, or not even listed peer reviewed journals, like not even recognized journals. If you just look through the references, it's like, well, that's a blog. That's published in a throwaway journal. That's not a peer-reviewed journal. It's like they're just cherry-picking terrible studies and then putting them together to make the case that they're trying to make. But
garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. But it's worse than that, because it's selected garbage. It's selected to tell a specific story, not to see what the evidence says. It's fitting the evidence to the story.
They start with a conclusion and then come up with the evidence necessary.
Right. And the fact that they had to go to such, the bottom of the barrel and cherry pick these crappy studies tells you that they couldn't do it with reliable studies, right? That the real data out there is not telling that story.
It seems to reinforce the other position. Actually.
Absolutely. Exactly. When you tried it really hard to make a case and you can't do it, that says something. That reminds me of so many things, but like one thing in particular, if you recall, the organic lobby essentially sued Monsanto preemptively, claiming that Monsanto is suing farmers for having seeds, GMO seeds, blow into, accidental contamination blowing into their farm, which Monsanto does not do. They've never done that. They don't do that. And interestingly, this is now in court, the organic lobby could not come up with a single case of it actually happening. So they had lawyers, they had money.
They proved
the opposite of what they were setting out to prove. So now you can reference that and say, well, show me a single case that it's ever happened. And in fact, in court, the organic lobby couldn't come up with a single case. So there you go. I mean, that actually ends up proving the opposite. So this is the same thing. They couldn't come up with reliable, high quality, peer-reviewed studies published in recognized journals. They had to pick blogs and throwaway, crap. That proves that the evidence is not out there to make their point. Otherwise, they never would have done that. Why would they have set themselves up to be so vulnerable unless they had no choice, but to cherry pick the crap in order to make their point. So anyway, like so many questions, yes, it's complicated. Yes, there's no simple answer. Yes, there's room for vigorous debate. But there is a consensus of evidence. It's not just a consensus of opinion. There's a consensus of evidence with the normal error bars that we deal with in science. And so no one is saying that this is it. This is 100% proven, no room for any further evidence or any debate. It's just that, at this point, with all the evidence we currently have, it's, the average estimate is 3 with a 95% confidence interval between 1.5 and 4.5. It's all bad. It's just different degrees of bad if we don't, prevent us from doubling our CO2 by mid-century. So is that enough to act on? I think so. I think that's enough to do some, common sense steps to start making the move over to energy sources that don't release CO2 in the atmosphere and, engage in energy conservation. There's all kinds of win-wins in doing that. Even, as I've said many times on the show before now, that even just the health benefits of not polluting alone will save money. You know, it's $100 billion a year in the U.S. alone of increased healthcare costs from pollution. And if we went to non-polluting energy production, our society on the whole would save money. It would be worth the investment, even if you don't calculate in global warming.
And of course, that's huge. That's a hell of an argument right there.
Yeah, if you do, it goes to the many, many, many billions. Yeah.
I want to also factor in what it'll take to have to reinforce all our seawalls and our infrastructure and
displaced people, displaced growing. You know, there's just so many. The cost of global warming could end up being in the trillions.
Oh, I think easily.
It doesn't make any fiscal sense. Like, guys, we can invest. We can invest now. Yes, it'll be expensive. Yes, it'll be a change. But that investment will earn us saved healthcare costs, saved all the potential costs of climate change, and we will be head towards less pollution in the world, and we'll head towards higher quality life in cities. And in fact, we'll head towards cheaper energy eventually. You know, actually, we're already there in a lot of ways.
We have to decouple this perceived threat to, say, our way of life, our capitalism, our economy, and all these other things, and really drive that point home in order to get more people on board with what's really going on. We have to really strike down those fake threats.
Unfortunately, these fake threats or perceived threats to capitalism, which is just not true. Yeah, right. You're right. It's a threat to capitalism to invest in future technology. We should go back to 100-year-old technology. That's what's good for the economy.
Silly.
Yeah, it's just silly. But it's also, I think, some people have observed, and I completely agree with this, that it's become part of the culture war. You know, it's no longer a war about evidence or about science. It's just us versus them culture war. You know, it's like the gun debate, unfortunately, too. The gun debate is all about culture war now. It's not about the evidence. It's not about rational policy. It's not even about the Constitution. It's not about what people say it's about. It's really about the culture war. You know, it's about they're attacking our culture, our way of life, and we're going to fight back. Yeah, that's it. Windmills are causing earthquakes in Oklahoma, not fracking. Right, right. It's the windmills. Yeah, that's it. They literally believe that in Oklahoma. Because that's an attack on their way of life. That's why.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah, decouple's a good word, Evan. We got it. You always have to. We all have to do this. These are obviously big examples, but we all have to separate our emotional beliefs, our identity, our worldview from science and evidence. Meaning that we can't subvert the evidence to our views. You know, we have to just say the evidence is what it is. Your values, you know, shouldn't be contingent upon certain facts, because then when those facts conflict with your values, you have to change your values, which people don't want to do, or they have to change the facts, which then, you know, gets into science denial, as opposed to saying, I have these values and I will accommodate the facts, but these are value judgments that are independent of any specific scientific claim. You know what I mean? It's like, I think that all people should be equal and have dignity, regardless of what the biology says. If you find some fact of biology that, you know, I'm not making a contingent on some fact that could be proven wrong tomorrow. You know what I mean? The ethical and moral principle stands on its own. In the culture war, science just gets caught in the crossfire. And we all suffer when that happens. Let's move on. Bob, I understand we've discovered yet more gravity waves. What's going on here?
Yay. Yes, this actually got better and better the more and more I read it. So, yes, a killer nova has been observed for the first time ever.
A killer nova?
Kilonova. These colliding neutron stars have been detected in yet another groundbreaking gravitational wave observation and concurrently in multiple electromagnetic frequencies. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. So let me kind of unpack all that. So first off, wow, what a couple of years LIGO is having. It's found a series of black hole collisions and now this. LIGO is, of course, the Light Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory, which we've talked about many times on the show, which measures the less than a proton's width disturbance in space-time caused by titanic events in the universe. Really big, big events, the biggest things, and colliding black holes and neutron stars, apparently. So this is fundamentally a new way to observe the universe, completely different from looking at various wavelengths of electromagnetism. LIGO has detected black hole collisions, and that's great. It's actually finding things about black holes that we really probably wouldn't have known otherwise. But we've been chomping at the bit for a neutron star collision, and that's what these so-called kilonovas are. And boy, did they find one. Now, we all know what neutron stars are, right? That doesn't mean I won't tell you, but they are again. Neutron stars are burnt out, compressed cores of large stars, not quite big enough to become black holes, but they are still obviously awe-inspiring. Here's a quickie. Have you guys ever imagined where are the protons and electrons in a neutron star? I mean, it's basically a big, one big neutron. Simplistically, that's basically what a neutron star is. Well, where did the protons and electrons go? Actually, they kind of smushed together to create more neutrons. So I'm just throwing that out there. Just a fascinating angle.
Bob. Yeah. Very cool.
So the gravity is so strong. Imagine our sun squeezed down to the size of Manhattan. That's kind of what we're dealing with. It's the densest visible object in the universe. A teaspoonful, you hear this all the time, a teaspoonful would weigh as much as Mount Everest, but that just gives you the idea of the density we're talking about. Anywho, so this blip came from a galaxy far, far away, 130 million light years away. And the sequence of events was interesting. The alerts were sent to LIGO researchers this past August 17th at 8:41 a.m. EST. And we've heard rumors for the past weeks and months. We knew something big was coming, and this is it. So this happened. These alerts were sent when all the LIGO antennas detected gravitational waves within milliseconds of each other. Then 2 seconds later, a gamma ray alert was sent from our orbiting Fermi gamma ray space telescope.
Good thing we have that.
Yeah, but you may be thinking, what do gamma ray bursts have to do with LIGO and gravitational waves? Usually you don't see those observations coupled. Well, colliding black holes really don't give off anything that we can see conventionally. It's kind of like two kind of invisible things smacking into each other and making these gravitational waves. But neutron stars are made of matter that we can actually see. So when they collide near the speed of light, wow, can you imagine that? Near speed of light collisions of two neutron stars, which is basically what happened. They also produce a plethora of detectable gamma rays plus X-rays plus radio waves, etc. So that's one of the reasons why this is so amazing, is that we saw those as well. So
now, did we see the gravity waves first?
Oh, yes.
That's awesome, I have to say, because that really is good confirmation that this whole gravity wave thing is real.
This is confirmation of lots of things. That's what I love about this. So many different things are like, oh, yep, this is kind of confirmed now. Yep, that too. That's also kind of confirmed now. So amazing. So now, but once news of this detection was known, astronomers ran. They flocked to their powerful telescopes, if they had them, all over the world and in space. And seriously, this was
Did any of them sashay over? Or
No sashay. When you hear a kilonova, there's no sashaying allowed. Nobody sashayed. But seriously, this was the most intensely observed space event in recent memory, as it should be. This was big. This was, yes, and as I said, this was the first time that we made an observation using both gravitational waves and electromagnetic radiation. This is called multi-messenger astronomy. And it's huge. So do you want even more icing on this cake? There's another layer of awesomeness. I recently talked on the show about how neutron stars were theorized to produce most of the precious and heavy metals, right, that are seen in the universe.
Gold.
Right. You can't look at supernovas and say, yep, that's where it all the heavy metals came from. No, there's it doesn't make enough of it to account for all the heavy metals that we see in the universe. Gold, platinum, uranium. So looking at the astronomical data that's been produced by this event, research have actually seen the direct fingerprints of these metals, these heavy metals in the debris. They've actually seen it. Very, wow. You know, really going a long way to absolutely verifying these theories of neutron stars creating the bulk of the heavy metals seen in the universe. So get this.
They do a spectral analysis and the bars show up.
So,
revealing basically, these certain elements.
So get this. Some 16,000 Earth masses worth in heavy elements have been.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Have been, yeah, 16,000. But this
How would that
better.
Disrupt our markets, Bob?
No. No, you want to hear, that more disruption. This is the disruption. I've read claims of at least 10 Earth masses in gold and platinum. 10 Earth masses.
Just
so,
in those.
I mean, talk about wiping out. Everybody gets a ton of gold for everybody. So, and having lots left over. So just amazing confirmation of that as well. And I'll end with a quote from astrophysicist Daniel Hotz. He said, "I can't think of a similar situation in the field of science in my lifetime where a single event provides so much staggering insights about our universe." So look it up online, read about it. This is a cool one.
You could make a Death Star entirely out of platinum if you had access to that kind of stuff.
Right.
Whoa.
Oh my God, you guys are such nerds. God.
How much would that cost, given today's dollar rate?
And they just got the physics Nobel. I mean, and then they come out with this. I mean, talk about, you know, throwing an exclamation point at the end of that.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
All right, Evan, I understand it's a very interesting candidate running for Congress.
Yeah, you're right.
Was this Florida?
South Florida, that's right, which includes the area of Miami, Florida, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Congressional candidate. She is one of 12 announced candidates running for Congress. And just so people around the world know, our Congress folk are elected every 2 years to the House of Representatives. There are 435 congressional seats throughout the country, and this is one of them. Her name is Bettina Rodriguez Aguilera, and she once claimed, this was in a television interview 8 years ago, that as a child, she was abducted by extraterrestrials and that they brought her onto their craft and they flew away with her in their spaceship called the Orville. No, it's not really called the Orville.
What?
Seth MacFarlane's new TV show. No?
Has she walked this back or is she like doubling down on this claim?
Not doubling down. In fact, she feels it's a distraction and that it's technically a hit piece in which she's... feels like it's inappropriate to be bringing up this old interview at this point.
But does she stand by that claim?
Well, she didn't deny it. According to Rodriguez Aguilera, she says the Miami Herald article, where this first arose, is clearly an attack piece. It ignores to mention I've dedicated over 40 years of my life as a business owner, teacher, economic developer, vice mayor, and community advocate, and instead emphasizes in a negative way an experience I had when I was 7 years old. So she admits... still to this day that the experience was real. She also says, she goes on to say that like the majority of Americans and scientists, I believe there's intelligent life in the billions of planets and galaxies in the universe and continuing to do my work for the community. That's all she had to say about it. So she did not deny it and seems to still believe in what had actually happened. Now, not only in that interview, not only did she say she was abducted and flew in the spaceship, but that she communicated with the ETs telepathically. It happened on more than one occasion. In fact, it happened several times while she was both an adolescent and a teenager.
Okay, so that's not just a small child.
It's not like one child.
Mystery member dream as a five-year-old. She was a teenager and thought she was psychically communicating with aliens.
That's right, into her teen years.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. She actually described the aliens.
The grays, whites, or reptilians.
humans or humanoids. Two women and a man. Very tall, full-figured, and blonde.
Oh, they were white.
Yeah. They wore robes.
The Nordic aliens.
They wore robes. And the spaceship was round. The aliens actually told her a message. This is the message they gave to her. God is a universal energy, not a person. It's in everything. God talks to people and they understand it in different ways, but there's only one religion. And she said that these beings, when they spread their arms wide open, reminded her of Jesus Christ, as he's portrayed in many pictures and these sorts of things.
Really? Aliens endorsed Jesus as the one true religion.
Apparently so. Where have we heard that before?
But also said that there is no real God and God is just an energy.
That's right. Energy, not a person.
So she's going to – like she's basically getting herself unelected every word that comes out of her mouth.
You want to hear a few other things she said in the interview too? that
yes.
are of note here, claims that the center of energy is in Africa, that 30,000 skulls different from human skulls are in a subterranean cave on the island of Malta in the Mediterranean, and that Coral Castle, which is a limestone structure in South Florida, sure if we talked about it before, maybe a long time ago, is actually an ancient pyramid. So she has actually she has several ideas here that certainly the skeptical community have talked about and tackled over, you know, the last several decades. And there seems to be sort of a pattern here, which is not surprising, because what is not unknown to psychologists and certainly not to skeptics is that there tend to be reasons why certain people believe that they've been abducted by extraterrestrials
or
experienced these sorts of things. Psychological processes, personality characteristics, proclivities for fantasy, and even when they go for help to try to deal with these sorts of things that they're dealing with, it sometimes involves hypnosis, and studies have shown that that actually just encourages and furthers the fantasy that they've sort of indulged themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, these are huge red flags, you know. Yeah. It's interesting to think about, though. I mean, would you say that belief in alien visitation and UFOs as alien spacecraft is a disqualifying in and of itself for a politician? You know, it's certainly something I don't like. But if it was just, you know, somebody who otherwise seemed reasonable but just had this silly belief in aliens, you know, wouldn't be a positive thing about them, but it wouldn't necessarily be a deal killer in and of itself. But this is different. This rises to a much higher level. If you're a teenager and you think that you're being abducted by aliens, that you're getting messages from them, that you're psychically communicating with them, yeah, that's very, very concerning.
She's 60 years old, so this did happen, apparently, by the math, in the early 70s, apparently.
Yeah, but, you know, she's not willing to distance herself from that now. I mean...
Yeah, right. She still appears to be holding on to her narrative.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And for whatever reason, won't let it go. Does it help her election chances? I don't think so. Does it disqualify her from holding office? Well, I guess not. You know, there have been other Congress folk who have had some pretty, you know, crazy ideas about aliens and other things.
Mm-hmm.
According to a poll I saw, they were able to extrapolate that roughly maybe 3 million Americans perhaps believe in alien abductions, and that would be roughly 1% of the population. So that would be 1 out of 100. And if there are 435 representatives, then maybe statistically, purely statistically, then it's not a disqualifier.
Yeah, but, you know, you would think that they would be the best and brightest of us, not just statistically representing lowest common denominator. I know.
They're so not.
I'm just saying that I don't necessarily buy that line of reason.
No, and I'm not. I don't either. But
I think that what she said about there not being one true God would be more disqualifying for most American voters.
Well, but she's just saying
that. She also advocated for Jesus.
Yeah.
It was like a weird thing. But like when you first started saying this, like there's not one – God is not a being, and it's an energy that flows through everything. I was like, oh, that would piss off some evangelical Christians for sure.
Right. It's so narrow-minded. I mean, could you imagine if you look at it from the perspective of our culture, of our country, if like somebody in India said, yeah, they were abducted by aliens who looked like Indians.
Yeah, I know.
And they said – they gave one message, and the message is that Vishnu is the one true God, or whatever. You know, really, that's what she's basically saying. That, yeah, the aliens have endorsed the narrow tribal religion of my people. It's just a little childish in a way.
Well, that's what would make me concerned if she were running in my district. I mean, obviously, as a skeptic, it would probably be pretty disqualifying right out the gate. But it would make me concerned about actually whether or not she is sensitive to delusions writ large. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I would think about that for sure.
Right. That's the practical, right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's a practical way of looking at it, Karen. Definitely. It would give me pause.
The last thing we need is another politician with a loose relationship with reality.
Oh, exactly.
Great. Oh, yep. My gosh.
Yeah. All right. Kara, there's some new news about DNA evidence and how reliable it is.
So, yes, so there's a piece out by ProPublica. They are interested in following up and covering a new study that's being put on by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is housed underneath the U.S. Department of Commerce. And this study is looking at the reliability of a specific type of DNA analysis that's actually called probabilistic genotyping. And so the ProPublica piece, if you're interested in reading it, it's by Lauren Kirchner, is a Q&A with an expert on probabilistic genotyping, basically asking, why does the National Institute on Standards and Technology, or of Standards and Technology, want to oversee this investigation? Why is it necessary now, and what purpose will it serve? So basically what they want to do at the NIST is they're doing like a large call for samples, private forensics labs and public forensics labs all over the U.S. to test DNA samples and look at the results and then make those results available. They want to look at the same samples across multiple labs and multiple forensic technicians so that they can see if a new standard for DNA analysis can be set. Now, the reason for that is because probabilistic genotyping is complicated. What it is, it's interesting. I was trying to look up a really clean definition of it online, and like I couldn't even find one. I think it's still kind of new. There's not even a Wikipedia page dedicated to it. But yeah, but probabilistic genotyping is basically what happens when forensics labs want to look at mixed DNA samples. So it's one thing if you go to a crime scene and there's blood on the floor or there's a semen sample on the floor and you test it and you see that there's one DNA profile inside of it. But things get increasingly more complicated. Let's say if we're talking about a rape kit, where a rape kit will often have the victim and the perpetrator's DNA. Or if we're talking about a crime scene where blood is mixed. Or more interestingly, and this is something that they talk about quite a bit in the Q&A on the ProPublica piece, is this idea of touch evidence, where let's say there's a fingerprint that's left behind. And in the past, all they could do was fingerprint analysis, like look at the shape and the structure of the fingerprint and compare it to a database, which has its own forensic concerns. We could talk about those separately. But now we're so good at PCR, polymerase chain reaction. We're so good at finding DNA in really, really small samples that it's not uncommon to lift actual skin cells out of a fingerprint and then test those skin cells. The problem is we have DNA transfer all the time. I mean, think about how many hands you shake in a day. Think about how many things you touch that might have DNA on it. And now you have all these mixed samples. And apparently it gets more and more complicated to tease out the individual profiles because you have to use probabilistic algorithms. So I wanted to read a quote by the individual that is interviewed in this ProPublica piece, John Butler. He's a DNA expert and he's written a lot of textbooks for forensic DNA analysts. He's also leading the team of scientists who are doing the study. So like he's the guy. And here's a really interesting quote. He says, "In my talk that I gave back in 2015, I made an analogy to math. You have basic math like 2 + 2 = 4. Basic arithmetic. That's the equivalent of single source DNA profiling. That works, and that's your gold standard. When you get to sexual assault evidence, when you have a perpetrator and a victim's DNA mixed together, that's algebra. Usually there's a high level of DNA there, and that's not an issue. But when you get to touch evidence, which is what we're increasingly seeing in the forensic field, that's calculus. So when we talk about DNA, it's not that calculus, it's not that the touch evidence of calculus is the gold standard. The gold standard is the use of DNA with databases in either single source samples or simple two-person mixtures. And here's the challenge. Labs are not prepared to do the complex mixtures. The reality is all the lab's proficiency tests, as I'm looking at them, are like basic math or algebra. So you're going into a final exam on calculus, but you've only ever done homework on algebra and basic arithmetic. Are you going to pass that exam? That's the reality of what we're facing." So basically, these labs are well-trained on basic DNA fingerprinting. They have software that does a very good job at basic DNA fingerprinting. And now there are these new proprietary software packages that they have to use because apparently the complex probabilistic kind of profiles that they have to do are too difficult and would be too time consuming for human beings to do them themselves. They actually require the power of the computer to help them go through all of those different probabilistic profiles. And so they're using software that is proprietary. Nobody knows what the base code of the software is, that sometimes actually two different software packages will give two different probabilistic results, which is pretty dangerous. And that, let's say the analysts themselves don't fully understand how to use, how are they to convince, or how are they to show a standard of or like a burden of proof to a jury when they're trying to make these sort of claims?
And it sounds like from what you're saying is that the technology for acquiring samples has outstripped the ability to analyze those samples.
Absolutely. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, we're good at collecting those samples, but those samples are so much more complicated than they've ever been. It's just a trace amount of DNA, and that DNA is mixed with a bunch of other sources of DNA. And so using these different analysis techniques to say there's a this chance, like a one in a million or a one in a billion chance that this is your guy, maybe it's not quite a one in a million or one in a billion, because you're having to tease it out from all the fractured DNA of a bunch of other sources. And those probabilistic levels get to be a little more complicated.
So, but I mean, especially if you're going to admit this as evidence in court, and it's very significant evidence because a jury hears DNA evidence and they're probably going to go with that, right? So this is, as you say, this is what's going to convict people. They need at least basic inter-rater reliability, right? If two different labs don't give you the same answer, there's a problem.
And that's what they want to do with this study is figure out, can at least multiple labs who are getting the same samples give us the same? And if not, we need to go back to the drawing board and we need to kind of put a moratorium on using this in court. The problem is, I think scientific standards in court are a little bit looser than we like to think that they are, because the courtroom game really is a game of who can better convince the jury. And they're going to throw as much stuff at the wall and see if it sticks. And I think that both prosecutors and defense attorneys know that if something sounds legitimate and sounds scientific, it's going to bear more weight in the courtroom. And it's dangerous. It's really dangerous that we don't, I don't think, have some like basic minimum standards, especially when we look at what's happening with doing this kind of inter-rater reliability on fingerprinting, on hair analysis, on bite mark analysis. After the fact, we're realizing that we've made some really tenuous connections to evidence.
Yeah, like everything else, just you need standards. You need enforced standards. Okay, so Jay is not going to be able to make the show this week, so no Who's That Noisy, but we do, as promised, have a review of the movie Blade Runner 2049. Bob, Evan, and I have seen the movie. Carrie, you were in Africa, so you didn't have a chance to see it. So you're going to listen in, maybe ask us questions, but you're not going to really be able to participate too much. But
and it's okay if you spoil it. I don't know how different the plot is from the original, so it'll be interesting to hear about that.
Very different, but
okay.
Well, yeah, we're gonna spoil it.
So yeah, so spoiler alert: if you haven't seen the movie, we warned you about it last week because you know when we talk about these movies, we don't pull any punches. We will completely spoil the plot. Okay, so Blade Runner 2049. This is a sequel to the 1980s classic Blade Runner, which is it's interesting. It was a movie that. It was sort of critically acclaimed, I think, and had a massive fan base, but was not really a financial hit.
It was considered a failure at the box office.
Yeah, not a box office success, but I mean, just had a lot of staying power. I've seen the movie over the years, and I think it totally holds up. Really, just an amazing film. And so when I remember almost a year ago when we heard that the sequel to Blade Runner was coming out, we saw the first teaser trailers. We were like, oh boy, they better not screw this up. this is a high bar for them that they've set for themselves here. So who wants to give their overall impressions to start?
Overall, I enjoyed this movie. I liked the major themes that they touched on, obviously about artificial intelligence, humans, how we interact. It's touching on a lot of the things we're actually talking about today in the world of science. So I really liked all of those themes. I liked how the movie looked. It's beautifully, beautifully shot. I mean, visually stunning. I also liked the effects were great, you know, as you would expect a science fiction movie of this caliber to have. They were really good. Characters, very interesting characters. So I enjoyed them. And I was certainly very satisfied at the end of the movie. I did have a few, I think, in retrospect, minor complaints about the movie. In regards to its length, I felt it did also, for me, drag a little bit during certain scenes. Although I do understand that they were trying to sort of match the length and pace of this movie as to the original. So I absolutely totally understand that and did not have an overall problem with that. A couple of the scenes I think were sort of unnecessary. There was a fight scene that takes place between Harrison Ford's character and Ryan Gosling's character. That's Deckard versus Kay, which I thought was just how they did it. I felt it was unnecessary. They sort of had this, it was a barroom fight scene, and they had this holographic image of this old Elvis Presley concert in Las Vegas, you know, from the 70s playing in the background. And it just struck me as a little too corny for me.
I disagree.
But again, overall, I very much enjoyed this movie, and we'll see, and I'll see it again.
Yeah. So I disagree that it was too long or that that scene was unnecessary. So okay. I have to say I loved this movie, and it's one of those movies where the more you think about it, the better it gets, which I love.
I agree with that.
So, you know, to me, this is one of those movies where, like, the theme and the subtext is as important as just the superficial plot. In fact, maybe even more important. The movie's supposed to make you think and feel, like, which is what good film does. And you know what I mean? So, for example, like, you talk about that fight scene between the two mm-hmm. of them. Was it necessary to the plot? No. But that's not, I think, why that scene was in there. So in this film, and again, as you say, worthy sequel to Blade Runner, totally captured and I think advanced the visually stunning, you know, dark future that Blade Runner, you know, Blade Runner, I think, was as popular as it was. Again, this not because of the story, but because of how just amazing the visuals were. Just blew you away with this vision of this dystopian future. And this movie does that too. But not only is this world dystopian, it's dying. This is a dead world. People are on their way out. That is definitely the feeling you get from this movie. And so you have these two characters, essentially like two of the main characters of the movie. They're basically in the graveyard of Las Vegas, mm-hmm. which, and we're just seeing ghosts of the past. You know, that hologram of Elvis and of Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Was ghostly and it was creepy and it was the tech was glitching and it was coming and going and
So you didn't mind the juxtapositions that was going on there?
No, it was deliberate.
I felt juxtaposition and it felt awkward to me.
Of what?
Of just what's you know, supposed to be this conflict, yet there's this amusement occurring.
It wasn't amusement. I didn't see it as amusement.
You didn't see it as that?
Not at all. It was a creepy ghost of a dead world. And then you have these two, you know, relics, you know, fighting in this graveyard of civilization, essentially.
So you found it highly symbolic.
Absolutely. 100%. Absolutely. I mean, the visuals of this movie were all, I think, you know, powerfully symbolic.
Okay.
You know, absolutely. So, and that's what I like about this film. So really, you know, the core, I think, question at the heart of this movie is what does it mean to be human, right?
Sure.
What does it mean? What is the nature of being conscious, of being human, of, you know, being an entity? And we get that from so many different angles. Like, for example, you have the human versus replicant thing. The humans obviously are on the way out in this movie, and they hate the replicants. They really, it's not just prejudice. They really hate the replicants.
That scene in the beginning when Kay walked by and that guy just, like, out of nowhere, just, like, just looked at him and just said with disdain dripping from his voice, like, skin job.
Yeah.
And really, like, you could just
really
see his
hatred.
Palpable.
Yeah. And then the Jared Leto character, mm-hmm. Wallace,
Wallace,
who's the, you know, the eccentric crazy billionaire who's making replicants.
He took over for Tyrell, basically.
Yeah, basically took over for Tyrell. He lays it out. He's like, listen, if we're going to populate the galaxy, we're going to have to do it with replicants, right? Replicants are the future. We're not doing it with humans. Humans aren't going to populate the galaxy. We're doing it with replicants. And of course, this is sort of the core plot of the movie, is this idea that if we're going to do that, we're not going to be able to manufacture them fast enough. So they have to be able to reproduce.
Right. Find a way to.
Yeah. That
to
was sort of
bear
the,
them or
the quest
sure
of the
born,
movie
right.
was to find these two replicants who were able to produce a child. And of course, Ryan Gosling, Kay, thought he was that child, but that wasn't correct either.
Two replicants? What do you mean two replicants?
All right, well, okay. So that's, I think, one of the unresolved questions in the movie is Deckard a replicant or not?
That is unresolved. That remains unresolved, right?
And Wallace suggests, he says a very provocative line where he says Deckard was made to fall in love with Rachel so that they would have a kid together.
Okay. I interpreted that as Tyrell basically put them together.
Yeah.
And to
but
force
it's ambiguous,
the situation.
As I said,
yeah,
it's ambiguous.
It is.
But it stuck out to me. Like, really?
But also, Steve, don't forget, I mean, you said, you know, populate the galaxy with replicants, but as my takeaway was like as slave labor.
Well, that's ambiguous too. We don't know that that's Wallace's plan, but you may be right. He clearly had no value. Like created that replicant, then killed it just to demonstrate how little value they have. She's barren, so I can just kill her with impunity. But still, I think that's what is being suggested here, is that the replicants are the future, and not just replicants, but AI as well. You know,
as far as Deckard, right. is he a artificial machine or is he actually a human? They sort of, I think, drop a little bit of a hint that Deckard might possibly be artificial because Kay, which is the Ryan Gosling character, the protagonist, is definitely artificial. And he is assuming the role that Deckard had in the first movie. So I think there's a very strong suggestion there, although no proof, no absolute.
I don't think you need a male replicant to fulfill this role. I mean, it's basically one cell, right? We're talking about one sperm is all the only thing that the replicant needs to produce. That's probably not going to be too hard, you know, for the replicant to for a replicant to do that. You know, it's really the woman, of course, is the hard tech. You know, it's that rest of that X chromosome. That's the tough piece. So I think it doesn't really matter that much if Deckard is human or replicant. I think he's human. I don't think he's a replicant.
But that question is left, you know. So the other sort of way in which, you know, the question of what makes us what we are, what makes us real, you know, like what makes you a real boy, that definitely the Pinocchio reference in there, is your memories, right? They made it kind of clear that you are your memories. And that was brought out in a few ways. So one was the girl who turns out to actually be Deckard's daughter, Deckard and Rachel's daughter, who is her job is to make memories to implant into replicants. And some of the memories, some are real.
Well, this was a change. This was a bit of a change from the original, in that they were like Tyrell used his niece, right? His niece's memories for Rachel, but now they explicitly say that they cannot insert. You know, legally, the standard practice is memories have to be created from scratch, and she, Deckard's daughter, was great at that. The implication was you can't use a real memory,
but she clearly did. And she said at one point the best memories are real. And that so Kay finds out that this memory that he has of him as a child, which he always assumed was an implanted memory, was a real memory. And it is a real memory. It just wasn't his real memory. It was somebody else's real memory. But there is this question. They say they give the replicants memory because then they behave human. So the memories make them human. Without the memories, they're not human.
Right. It's a cushion for their emotions, so that their emotional, you know, outlook and behavior is more normal. Because with no memory cushion there, weird stuff can happen.
Let me ask you guys this: who was the most human, empathic, you know, alive character in the movie?
Ooh.
Joey. The artificially intelligent.
Oh, the absolute artificial. Yeah. Joey was Kay's love that they
Yeah, his computer wife. Yeah,
right. Computer.
So she was a computer program, and you know, was a hologram, but she clearly was very, you know, she was vivacious. She was, you know, very alive, very emotional. You know, very expressive. Yeah. You know, and obviously, you know, that's why
much more so than Kay. Much more so than Kay, and that's one of the things
Kay
that initially got
shut down. He was very, very.
That's what got
flat.
Me. Right, I was kind of bummed. I was kind of bummed about that. Like, you know, he's just being too flat, you know. And but I think you could also look at it conversely as an amazing acting job, because he still communicated everything he really needed to communicate, even though he was kind of flat. And I think that was what he had to do.
He was flat for a reason, though.
Of course, and you should mention this reason, but it also made his outburst when he was talking to Deckard's daughter. It made it even more just like, whoa, a slap in the face. It was like, damn, he's pissed.
But remember, his model was made more obedient. And I think it was very clear that he was just browbeaten. He was beaten down. He was an obedient dog.
Yeah, he had the slave mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like when that guy, part of the reason why I think they had that scene where the other cop says, he's, you know, stupid skin job. And he just looked down like a dog when that happened. That's that one little exchange told us so much. And then, of course, we meet the other replicants who are rebelling. And Gosling himself has this outburst at the end where you're like, finally, a human emotion from this guy.
Right.
So I think the point is that the replicants, are you're not going to be able to keep them down. They are going to absolutely rebel.
Right.
You know, because they are human, because they are real, you know, despite the fact that some of their memories may be implanted, or they may, you know, have certain programmed personality. That doesn't mean that they're not real, you know. And I think it was also really interesting the conflict that Kay, you know, Ryan Gosling's character had with respect to his computer wife, because he clearly treats her as real, but then and then she's destroyed, and then he encounters essentially a sales model, you know, of Joey. And
a 10 foot tall.
Oh, that's right. The 30 large
foot,
image.
Yeah, 30 foot tall. 30 foot
that,
sales model.
Yeah,
and
that was
and
a hell of a scene.
The overlap in personality was striking, and the look on his face said, shit, she's not even real, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was.
But he definitely felt the loss when she was destroyed. There was no doubt about that.
Yeah. So
no doubt about that.
Yeah, just another way in which we as the audience are questioning, was she real? Did she really love him? Or was that just all programming? Does it matter? You know? It was fantastic. I just love that
Yeah,
whole,
it makes you think. It makes you think deeply about these things.
Right, right. And just and again, it was a long movie. You don't expect an action flick.
No.
You've got to settle in. It's
and
a long
movie. Not a Michael Bay
And
no.
that's right. That's one of the things I loved about it is they in a way they weren't like condescending to the audience, thinking, yes, well, we got to have explosions every 10 minutes or they're going to get bored. Like, no,
no,
it's an investment. You sit back, relax,
but just
soak
enjoy
it in, enjoy it.
Just
enjoy
it.
It was, and it actually took me a while to, like you said, Steve, I loved when you said that the more you thought about it, the more you love this movie, because at first, you know, I really, really enjoyed it, but the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you know, we're programmed, ironically, we're programmed to expect these explosions and action every 10 minutes, and it was so refreshing to see a movie that you know, said you don't need to see action and stuff like that every 10 or 15 minutes like clockwork. You don't. It was just a well-written, well-acted, and I was so happy they didn't, you know, they could have done a money grab. They could have made a sequel. They could have even, oh my God, imagine if they even tried to reboot this. Holy crap. I think that all would have been horrible. That all would have been horrible. They did, what they did was really kind of miraculous.
Made a beautiful film.
And it was a beautiful film that complements and extends the original in a way that I cannot think of another sequel off the top of my head that did it this well and this in such a refreshing, surprising way.
Sequels are always very tricky.
Oh, my God.
Very tricky.
Especially to a cult classic like this. I mean, they the possibilities for failure were massive. And I was very happy with it. I enjoyed the movie. I loved it in the theater. And I've the more I've thought about it since, the more I've liked it. As opposed to other movies we've seen, like, Star Wars 7, right? Where it's kind of a thrill in the theater, and it's like, oh, we're getting our Star Wars geek on, you know? And But then the more you think about it, the more it upsets you, because you realize how crappy the plot was and all the holes.
Right.
It didn't make sense, and why'd they do this, and God, that was cheap.
They tried to follow the formula, and it just felt...
They got to have this guy do a Star Wars movie, really make it into like a piece of art. Imagine that.
That would be something. Yeah, but so it comes down to the writing too. Yeah, yes, this was a beautifully directed movie, visually stunning, but the writing was so intelligent and it was so good.
Right. When you have all that together, you've got good special effects, amazing visuals so awesome that you could just sit back with the volume on zero and still enjoy what you're seeing.
Yeah.
Like that reminds me of not Road Warrior, the latest reboot of Mad Max, right?
Fury Road.
Yeah, that reminded me of Fury Road, where you could probably enjoy a lot of that movie just with no sound because the visuals were just so stunning. It was the same thing. So this brought it all together with not only visually and special effects, but the writing and the acting. And we've said this many times, when that all comes together, that's when you really have something special. And this got as close to that ideal as we've seen in a while. And there's not many movies that I would compare that to.
I agree. It's the best movie I've seen in a while. So, and again, that's my prejudice too. Just that, I am always looking to see if a movie is a film, right? I mean, is it using film as a unique artistic medium? It's not just telling a story. It's not just treating us to cheap action and explosions, as you say, but is it really, making the most out of film as an art form. And this was a film, and it really, in the best sense of the word, telling a story visually, that's what films do. And if it's not doing that, then it's really not being, I think, true to the medium or not getting the most out of it. Then it's not living up
to its potential.
Then it's just a cheap movie. It's a flick that you see for it, which is fine. I enjoy good flicks and entertaining, fun eye candy. It's all good. I'm not being judgmental about that, but I also love it when I get that wrapped in a beautiful work of art film. Love it.
Another thing was that although there are religious overtones, obviously, to this movie, Immaculate Conception, among other things, you weren't sort of hit over the head with it. It didn't feel too heavy-handed, and it was conveyed in a very good, enjoyable way, as opposed to, say, a movie like Prometheus, which I think, ironically, another Ridley Scott, venture that totally got that wrong. I felt so there are ways to do that. Make these elements regarding if these overtones. Subtle as opposed
to... Wait, what did Ridley Scott do in this film? Did he direct it or did he just produce it?
Directed by Denis Villeneuve.
There you go.
He produced it, right. But he was responsible for the original Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Right.
It's good that he passed the torch because the
director...
I think he would have butchered it.
The director of this movie did Arrival, which was another wonderful movie.
Arrival's like one of my favorites.
Yeah, same guy.
Shit, then I'm going to love this movie. Now you guys, I would say you guys have totally spoiled it for me, but I kind of wasn't listening to anything you were saying.
Good.
Awesome. You're so lucky.
See this movie. I think you'll really, really like it. Yeah, this is, I really heartily endorse it. Yeah, just get it. But the one caveat is you got to settle in for a long, relatively slow moving movie compared to what is out there. But if you go in with that expectation, and just luxuriate in it and take the time to really look at it and experience the movie and think about it, you'll really enjoy it, in my opinion.
I still think it could have been 10 minutes shorter, but that's just personal.
Every second was gold. Okay. Let's move on. Just a couple of questions and emails this week. I'm not going to actually read specific emails because we got so many on two different topics. I'm just going to summarize the consensus of the emails that we were getting. So first, we sort of crowdsourced a physics question to our very intelligent listeners last week about the thermos physics, if you remember. So the original question was, if I have this really good vacuum thermos, and when I put hot liquid in it, it doesn't get hot. But when I put ice cold liquid in it, it feels cold on the outside, even though it's doing its job. It's keeping cold stuff cold and hot stuff hot. Why is there this difference? Why is there this asymmetry in terms of how well it's insulating my hand, you know, from hot versus cold? And we didn't really have an answer, which is why we kind of threw it out there. But we sort of reviewed the physics of thermoses and said, well, maybe there's a difference in the way it's reflecting the heat one way more than the other, or maybe it's just a flaw in the design. Maybe it's sealing better with the hot than the cold. And so a lot of listeners wrote in with their thoughts, and I think there were two points that stuck out to me. And one, I'm kind of kicking myself for not thinking of myself, because it's something that we definitely know. It just didn't occur to me at the time. And that's the phase transition.
Yes.
So we were talking about the difference in temperature, that like hot coffee is probably hotter than room temperature, than an iced drink is colder than room temperature. But ice goes through a phase transition, and that would absorb a lot more energy than just the change in the temperature itself. So an ice cold drink might actually absorb much more energy than a hot drink would give off. So that's one factor. But the other one I thought was very interesting, and so several people pointed out that if you just have a steel thermos that's empty, the steel will feel colder than the air around it because it absorbs energy from the surroundings. So to your hand, it'll feel a little cool. Like you guys had that, right? If you touch certain kinds of objects, it feels a little cool to the touch, even if it's equilibrated with room temperature. So they said, they speculated that maybe if you put hot coffee into a steel thermos, it'll heat up just enough on the outside that it counteracts that cooling effect. And so it feels normal. It doesn't feel warm. It feels room temperature. But if you put a cold liquid in there, it makes it a little bit colder, and it's already feeling a little on the cold side. So then you notice how cold it feels. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So it's already starting, because steel would feel a little bit cooler than room temperature at baseline. So I think both of those were reasonable answers, and I think that adds to our discussion. So thanks to everybody who wrote in with those two bits of information. The other one is, we got a lot of feedback about our mindfulness meditation discussion that we did last week. And we don't have time to like really rehash the whole thing, because it is sort of a complicated issue. But I will point out the fact that I wrote about it on Science-Based Medicine Today. So if you look for my Science-Based Medicine post for October 18th, or just search for mindfulness meditation, I went into it in great detail, but let me give you the quick summary. So a lot of people were saying, yeah, I thought you guys were being too hard on it. Yeah, sure, the science may not be solid, but you know, I use it and it helps me with this, or it clearly works. So partly I felt like people were giving me the old, well, it works for me answer, which kind of misses the point of the criticism. And I think perhaps we were coming off as more negative than we intended, because I never said it's useless or it doesn't work. My point really had two big points. One was, there really isn't an operational definition of what mindfulness meditation is. And if you don't have a very specific definition of what something is, you can't study it scientifically. And when you try to study it scientifically, it's just going to be a mess. There is a lot of research, and a lot of interesting research, and psychologists are seriously trying to isolate what the variables are. And there's potentially a lot of them, which is the problem. And I'm not saying that there isn't a mechanism in there that might have a specific effect or be interesting, but the point is, the research needs to go there. Otherwise, we're never going to be able to answer these questions. You can't just use the vague definition of mindfulness in research, because then the results are uninterpretable and you end up basically just documenting a lot of non-specific effects, and we don't know if those non-specific effects are in any way what the relationship is to what people are calling mindfulness or doing under this broad umbrella of mindfulness. So, for example, some of the components that researchers have pointed out include the relaxation aspect of it. It also includes focusing your attention in a certain way. It includes avoiding mind wandering, being in the moment, introspection. These are all things that that researchers are looking at. And then they have more technical terms for a lot of those things as well. So for example, so the more technical terms, they might talk about decentering and inhibitory control, non-conceptual discriminatory awareness, acceptance and reintegration, focused attention, decentering, meta-awareness. What are all these things? They're interesting, but that's a lot of different, you know, maybe not totally nailed down psychological phenomena that are just being studied. And until we sort out specifically what individual people are doing and what specific phenomenon is happening and control for that variable in a blinded way with active control so that we know it's not just a non-specific effect, we can't really make any conclusions about it. And then, so a lot of people point out, well, but there are good studies where they do control for things like relaxation. But that misses the other point of this review that we were talking about, and that is the well-controlled studies. So most are not well controlled and are, in my opinion, uninterpretable. And the ones that are well controlled, the results are either moderate or minuscule or negative. So it's mixed results towards the unimpressive end of the spectrum. And that's a pattern we're familiar with too, right? That's the pattern that we see when you research lots of things that isn't real. And again, when I say isn't real, I don't mean that when you do what you are calling mindfulness, that you do not derive any benefit from it, that you don't feel that it helps you relax or that it helps you with your depression or that it helps in you in some way feel a better quality of life. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it isn't a specific phenomenon with a specific effect. It's just a way of achieving some other phenomenon that has maybe non-specific effects. But the bottom line is we really don't know because there aren't any robust, replicable, clear, well-controlled effects here. And this is important. It's important to be able to ask and answer these questions scientifically because then otherwise, you know, we can't move this ball forward. Because the other thing is you could prove that anything works if you take this kind of loose approach to it. And that's a problem. To me, the research is more important than this one question, you know, of mindfulness, to be honest with you. The standards of research that we need to adhere to. Because if you allow for this sort of slippery research where you don't have well-controlled variables and you're not controlling for them well, then anything rides through that door. And we're seeing it. It's happening. That's the same, you know, homeopathy can ride through that door and acupuncture and mind-body medicine and, you know, energy healing and any kind of nonsense you could imagine has exactly the same level of research in
support. That door sucks.
Yeah. So again, it doesn't mean that it's not a useful technique for things or that it's not helping you. It means that if we're going to study it scientifically, this is what we need to do. We need to define it more specifically and we need to control for variables better. That's what the reviewers were saying. They were saying it in with a full, really thorough review of all the literature. And they were doing it in very highly technical terms. And, you know, we were just trying to summarize that in sort of more layman's terms. But those are the bottom line. And so writing in and saying, yeah, but I felt better when I did it. Good for you. It doesn't change anything that those researchers are saying. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my fellow skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. This week, we have a theme, and we have four items, because it's a quick and easy theme, so you'll see it's four items is better. The theme is coral. How much do you guys know about coral?
Oh, no. I know nothing about coral.
Okay, well, we'll find out.
Is she a character on SpongeBob?
Yeah. I didn't even know that.
They also use the word coral instead of cool. That is so coral.
Okay. I like that.
Steve knows it better than me. Just saying. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Here we go. Four items about coral. Item number one, an atoll is a ring-shaped island that is left behind after its barrier reef has died. Item number two, a coral's mouth is also its anus. Item number three, individual coral polyps may be male, female, both, or neither, and corals reproduce either sexually or asexually. Whoa. And item number four, tropical white sand is mostly comprised of coral that was pooped out of a parrotfish. There they are. And Kara, since you know nothing about coral, why don't you go first?
All right. I'm going to make these judgments based on visiting beaches. Let's see. I think that I do know a little bit about geography, and I do think that an atoll is, I know it's an island. I know it's like a reef island or a coral island, or at least I'm pretty sure that that's the case. I don't know if it's ring shape. That's the one that's getting me, but I feel like why would you say that randomly if the other two were true? So I'm going to say that that one's science. A coral's mouth is also its anus. That seems reasonable. They're stuck, right? They're stuck and they kind of filter feed. They can't poop back into the reef, can they? I don't know. That one seems reasonable. I'll go with that. Individual coral polyps may be male, female, both, or neither. Okay, there's a lot to unpack in that sentence. And corals reproduce either sexually or asexually. So basically, there are no rules. Corals are freaky deaky. They can do or be any gender. I don't know. I don't know. That one's bumming me out a little. It's a bit crazy. It might be true, but it's bumming me out. Let's see. Tropical white sand is mostly comprised of coral that was pooped out of a parrotfish. I mean, I've looked at sand under a microscope before, and a lot of it is like little shells. It's also, I think, a lot of coral. But I don't know if you're saying specifically white sand. Like, is that as a, I get that that's as opposed to black sand, like volcanic beaches, or red sand or green sand beaches like you see in Hawaii. But is that also as opposed to like a tan or brown sand beach? I don't know.
I'll tell you, no, it's different than that. So white sand
is different.
It's
okay.
Different than the normal like blonde sand.
Gotcha.
That you see
yeah.
On a regular beach.
Then I think that one is maybe true. I think that one's maybe science. So I think the one I'm going to say is the fiction is that coral polyps can be male, they can be male, female, they can be hermaphroditic, or they can be asexual, and they can produce sexually or asexually. I think that's too much. I don't buy it. So I'm going to say that's the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, Kara makes a lot of sense on a lot of these. An atoll, yeah, it is. I mean, everyone that I've seen is kind of ring-shaped or semicircular. The fact that, what you say at the end, that it's left behind after its barrier reef has died, that I don't know. Makes sense though, because you know it's above the water. It's not where usually or parts of it are, so it's not going to be really living if it's above the water. So that kind of makes sense. And the coral mouth is also its anus. Sure, I mean that's like Kara said, it's attached. So it kind of makes sense that it would kind of be like, oh, let's go back the way we came. Doesn't sound like fun though. Yeah, the white sand. At first, I was like, oh, I'm not sure about this one because I know beach. Sand on beaches is essentially shells that are broken up over the eons, which is interesting because Hawaii, like the big island of Hawaii, I think it only has like a couple beaches, real beaches, because the island is so geologically young that there hasn't been enough time for beaches to really form. So they kind of have to ship in the sand, which is really interesting. So, but yeah, I guess there is different types of sand, and the white sand, yeah, it kind of makes sense that it could be this coral from this parrotfish. But it does seem a little bit too specialized for entire beaches. So I'm a little skeptical about that one. But the third one here about these coral polyps, the polyps can be crazy. I mean, but yeah, male and female, or both, or neither, and asexual, it's just like way, it's too much. It's too crazy. I mean, if it was half that crazy, I might buy it, but this is just too crazy. So I'll say that's fiction as well.
Okay, Evan.
I'm torn because Kara brought up a great point that Bob reiterated about it being male, female, neither, both, sexually, asexually, too much going on there, too much ambiguity. But the one that's got me is the ring-shaped island left behind after its barrier reef has died. I thought an atoll is a ring-shaped island of coral. So I'm not sure if there's just I'm maybe misinterpreting this one about its barrier reef that has died. I didn't know that that was a component to this, obviously. I'm not a coral expert by any stretch. Oh, so I was leaning towards that one, but now Bob and Kara may be dragging me into this other highly ambiguous one about its sexuality. And so I'm just going to have to. All right. I'm going to go. I'll go with Kara and Bob. I'll join the bandwagon. They convinced me. I would not have chosen it otherwise.
No,
I don't think.
I'm scared, you guys.
So I'm going there and I'm leaving. But if it's not this one, I think it's going to be the ring-shaped island left behind after barrier reef has died. That'll be fiction. But I'll go with I'll go with Karen Bob.
Well, we're gonna have some kind of sweep this week.
Yeah, something's getting swept.
Yeah, you guys heard me tell you that I know nothing, right?
No. All right. So,
oh, wait, I thought you said everything.
Let me start with the one that you guys seem to all have no problem with and agree upon the most. Number two, a coral's mouth is also its anus. You guys all think this one is science, and that one is science.
Yay.
And that was the easy one I threw in there. That's why I wanted to have four. And because I had to have, just it was fun to say that. So, so yeah, so the coral is a colony creature, right? So each, the polyp is the individual organism, and a polyp is, it has like tentacles around the mouth, and the tentacles have little stingies that they use to sting their prey.
Stingies. Is that the scientific term?
Yeah, they are stingies. And then they eat, they eat stuff through the mouth and they poop it out through the same hole. So their mouth and the anus are the same thing. Yeah, they're stingy things. The tentacles are tipped with what are called stinging cells.
I love it.
The technical term is nematocytes, but they're stinging cells. So that it just goes in and comes out the same way because there's no back end. The back end is where the skeleton is because they secrete, you know, the calcium carbonate. And that's the hard skeleton that we know of as the coral, right? The big structure of coral, right? Okay, let's go to number four. That was the second least discussed one. So tropical white sand, that's controversial. Tropical white sand is mostly comprised of coral that was pooped out of a parrotfish. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is also science. This
We're crazy.
Well, that's a lot of parrotfish then, huh?
I know.
Oh, yeah. Takes a long time. So, there's different kinds of sand. So basically, the sand is made out of whatever's there. Right. So you have black sand where you have like black volcanic rock. You have regular sand is made out of it's actually not mostly shells. It's mostly rocks. It's mostly rocks. There's like quartz sand and other things that make up the sand, depending on what's local. Yes, there's shells there as well. But the white sand, like some tropical beaches have this beautiful, really white sand. Mm-hmm. And when they analyzed that sand under the microscope, they realized that it was all bits of coral because coral is white, right?
Dead coral is, right?
Well, the coral itself is white. Coral gets its color from the algae that symbiotically lives in the coral. That's why the problem with the bleaching coral, the coral turning white, is that its algae is dying.
Yeah, that's the problem. There's just nothing living on it anymore. Right.
Yeah, but the coral itself is already white. And I see. the parrotfish eats the algae, and it kind of like bites little pieces of coral with the algae. Like it bites the algae off the coral and takes a little bit of coral with it, and then it poops out the coral, but it actually does break it down into little sand before it poops it out. So it's the parrotfish pooping out little bits of coral is making up the vast, 85% of the white sand, tropical white sand, is pooped out of the parrotfish.
Wow.
Which is different than other types of sand, which is other constituents based on the location. Okay, so let's go to number one. An atoll is a ring-shaped island that is left behind after its barrier reef has died. You guys all think this one is science, although Evan thinks it's maybe the other way around, that the island is the reef.
And I don't know if it's ring-shaped.
Okay, and Bob seems pretty sure it's ring-shaped. Kara doesn't know if it's ring-shaped, but you all went with this. And this one is the fiction. Because Evan was exactly right.
I was
you
lured.
Were exactly right, and you didn't have the confidence to go with your
I got swayed.
So there are three kinds of reef, and of course a reef is a huge structure of coral, right? A fringe reef, as the name implies, is like a fringe around an island. So imagine an island, and then you have a circular fringe around the island, but underneath the top of the ocean, right? So it's all below the water. When it builds up high enough so that it peaks out above the water, it becomes a barrier reef. Because now it's a barrier to the open ocean, and the water inside the barrier reef is a lagoon. So then you have the island, and then surrounding the island is a lagoon, and surrounding the lagoon is a barrier reef, and then open ocean. Right? But what happens over time is that the island in the middle wears away, or it may be sinking beneath the waves. And the barrier reef stays above the water, And so it's a ring, right? It's a ring around the island that stays behind after the island in the middle has gone away or is now below the water level. And so an atoll is the reef. It's not left, right? It's not an island. I mean, you can call it an island reef, but it is it's the barrier reef. And that's called an atoll. So a fringe reef becomes a barrier reef, becomes an atoll when the island it's in the middle goes below the top of the water. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, it does.
Right. So
sadly, it does.
That means that individual coral polyps may be male, female, both, or neither, and corals reproduce either sexually or asexually is true. That is science. Ooh. They are very varied and interesting little buggers. They have a very interesting life cycle.
Wow.
So
polyps
the coral polyps can reproduce asexually by budding, or they can release male and female gametes. And an individual polyp could release sperm and be a male polyp, or it could release eggs and be a female polyp, or it could be release both and be a hermaphrodite polyp. Mm.
Well, the evolution
corals,
advantages there are many.
Corals can be comprised of males, females, or hermaphrodites. So an individual, like a coral colony could be all male or all female or both, but an individual polyp could be male or female or both.
Right.
Or asexual or not reproduce at all. You know, so it could be neither in that it doesn't produce any gametes. So every permutation is seen, you know, among the various species of coral, which is
wow. If there's a coral Facebook, their gender selection must be very complicated.
And there's also another layer here, and that is how do they release their gametes? So some just release them into the surface of the water, and then they find each other somehow. Sometimes the males will release them.
That's
into
no
the female, and some corals, the males and female gametes get together outside. Sometimes they get together in the mouth of the male, and those are brooders, right? Wow. Lots of every permutation basically exists in the world of polyps and corals. Very cool.
And one of the highlights of my life with you guys was in 2010 when we went to Australia and we actually went to the Great Barrier Reef. That was so
gorgeous.
Memorable and
gorgeous.
Jennifer, my wife, and I, we still talk about that trip.
Yeah, I did the quickie. We did the quickie scuba diving training, and then we went down and we saw this giant clam.
Oh.
And remember, they had me put my arm in it first.
And it closes
and it
up.
It closed my hand. for a nanosecond, I was like, I just lost my arm.
Yeah.
But it was the... Oh my God! The musculature surrounding that curvy clam on the inside was the softest skin. I compare it to like the snout of a horse. You ever feel ever like pet that
velvety
snout of a horse?
Feel to
velvety
it.
Skin. That's how it felt. It was wonderful. Of course, you guys eagerly put your hands in after I was the guinea pig.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, it's safe.
It's definitely awesome. A bucket list kind of thing to do. Visit the Great Barrier Reef. Gorgeous. So we're going to be at SciCon next week. Don't forget about our private show Friday night at 10 p.m. We've gotten a lot of reservations already. We might still have a few seats left, but they're going quickly. So send us an email if you want a seat at the private show. It's $75. A lot of fun. Always, these shows are always a lot of fun for us, and our audiences love them too. And they have a tendency to sell out. So send us an email if you want to reserve a spot. And we have opened up a new swag selling site.
It's ready.
Yeah, it's not fully done, but it's you could go there and buy stuff. You know, I sort of picked the low hanging fruit. Just put we're going to be expanding the number of things that we're offering, but there's already mugs and T-shirts and prints and other stuff that you can get. So it's at TeePublic. That's TeePublic. TeePublic. Just go there and search for The Skeptic's Guide. And you will, you'll find it. We're going to have links and stuff put on our site, but it's not there yet. And I think we might be at the tail end of our opening sale, but that's just a short lived thing anyways. That's not really critical in my opinion, but just go there. And, it's a great way to get your SGU swag and help support the SGU. We will be greatly expanding the offerings, hopefully over the next, few months and then just ongoing into the future. And if there's anything you'd like to see there, let us know. Right now, we're just sort of using our existing artwork that we have, the ones that are compatible with the items that they have. But we'll be putting some time and effort into that over just into the future. But so keep an eye out there, and we'll let you know when new stuff goes there. So the old store on the website, we haven't taken it down yet, but we really need to, because we're just, so don't use that anymore. If anyone's ordered anything and they didn't get them, we're going to be sort of, I'm making an effort to get out any outstanding orders to the old store. And then once all of those are out, it's going to be shut down completely. And then we're going to be fully moved over to the T Public store. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. This has a lot more potential for us, a lot more types of items that we can offer. And it's all print on demand, so we don't have to keep any stock, and we'll still have stock to bring to conferences, but for online stuff, this is the way to go online, right? Just print on demand. That's absolutely the way to go. Yeah. Well, Evan, you have a quote for us this week?
Yeah, the quote was suggested by listener Mike Young from Mississippi. Thank you, Mike. I'm scared to death about the denial of science. Science is real. Science is the most real thing in our world, other than nature. I'm hoping we'll get back to a place where we can really understand that science is tested knowledge. Spoken by Harrison Ford. Speaking of Blade Runner, speaking of Deckard, it all comes full circle.
Damn.
Harrison Ford was speaking at the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery, where he received the James Smithsonian Bicentennial Medal for lifelong work on behalf of global conservation.
Well, that's neat.
I like that idea of science as tested knowledge. I like that.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I've heard that before.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it.
Good for Harrison standing up and helping everybody understand it.
Yep. It's always so good to hear an actor who's not just a complete idiot.
Yes.
The bar is really low. Really low bar, just not an idiot. I'll be happy with that. But that was good. I like that. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely, Stevie.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.